Today is Sanctity of Human Life Sunday, and as we do every year, we have called your attention in the bulletin to some of the statistics. They're frightening, really, to realize that it was 41 years ago that the Supreme Court decision that we know as Roe versus Wade took place, legalizing abortion in America. And there are lots of websites you can go to, but generally speaking, if you're looking for this kind of statistic information, the statisticians tell us that we're looking at somewhere in the range of 55 million innocent Americans have been the fate of abortion since that time. That's one example. There are a lot of things around us, I think, that would make it pretty easy to be discouraged. And really, when we look at this psalm, and this is where maybe I hope to show you a direction in the psalm that hasn't maybe occurred to you before, we are hearing the voice of discouragement from this psalm. The thing about it is, there's another voice in the psalm as well, and that's what we want to look at in the message this morning. Verse number one says to us, "In the Lord put I my trust. How say ye to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain." You can look at the superscription. Not long ago in talking about another psalm, I pointed out that the superscriptions are not inspired, but they're the best opportunity we have to know what typical Bible scholarship over years and years, I mean Jewish tradition, felt about the psalm. And it tells us here that the author of the psalm was David. But you'll notice, like, unlike other superscriptions, when sometimes you have them, there is notation here about what the occasion of the psalm was. So we have to be careful about this. But I might say this, that probably what is most plausible, since David wrote the psalm, and especially when you look at the content of the psalm, that we're looking at some time and circumstance in his life during his reign as king when he was experiencing a tremendous challenge. We find this as the thing unfolds. Look at verse number 2. "For lo, the wicked bend their bow. They make ready their arrow upon the string, that they may privily shoot at the upright in heart." And I would point out to you that there's something really interesting to notice about this, because David was a military man, so often David would express himself in military terminology. But to me, something that is really interesting about this is to notice that as David views this, even though in that verse that I just read, he does talk about arrows and those kinds of things, he doesn't view this challenge that has come to him as king as a military problem so much as he deals with it and views it as a moral problem. Why do I say that? Well, look at the verse again and just watch the terms that are in it. "For lo, the wicked..." See, that's a moral term. That makes a moral judgment. And then it goes on to say, "They bend their bow, they make ready their arrow upon the string, that they may privily shoot at" whom? "The upright in heart." So even though David is facing this challenge, he views it not so much in a... It's not, in other words, we don't have something here, more than likely, we do not have something here where David is being attacked, or the nation of Israel is being attacked by external foes. Instead, what we have is something internal. Now, if you want to talk about discouragements, I'll make an observation for you. I would have to say that thinking about times of discouragement, that sometimes it's not so much the external ones, but it's the internal ones that can be more devastating. Here you are. This is a challenge to David's leadership. He's the king of the nation. Whoever these people are, they're uncooperative, unsupportive of his leadership, and they challenge his role in that capacity. Well, that can be discouraging. In fact, that's what David is surrounded by. David is surrounded by the voice of discouragement. Because if you'll notice again, watch this. This is really important to discern the two speakers or the two voices that are here. Because David is talking in verse number one, and he says, "In the Lord I put my trust." And then he says, "Why or how say ye?" Which, of course, you know, "ye" is "you" plural. He's speaking to the people around him. "Why are you saying to me, flee? Why are you saying to me, flee as a bird to your mountain?" And he goes on to continue to quote what people are saying to him. This is the voice of discouragement. There are people who are saying to him in these circumstances in which his leadership has been challenged, There are people who are saying to him, flee. Flee as a bird to the mountain. And they continue and they say, look how bad it is all around. Lo, the wicked bend their bow. They make ready their arrow upon the string, that they may privily shoot at the upright in heart. And then, here's our text, and this is how you have to see this, because this is the voice of discouragement continuing. These are the people around David who are fainting in their hearts, who are affected desperately by this discouragement, this challenge that has arisen. And they say, almost as an excuse, but also in articulation of their discouragement, if the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? What can we do? We might as well just flee. We might as well just abdicate. Now, I realize, and I want to be careful to point this out, there was a time in David's life that he did exactly that, remember? When he was challenged by Absalom. This is a similar kind of a thing. Circumstances were quite different there. Why David made the decision to actually flee in that instance and why his response to the people around him now who are overpowered by this discouragement is quite different. There are very different circumstances. But that's what's going on here in this psalm. It's people who are saying to David, well, look, it has gotten so desperate. It has gotten so difficult around us. I mean, all of these problems are so overwhelming. That, why don't you just flee? Why don't we just get out of here? You ever felt that way? I want to ask you a question because I'm talking about David, but I also want to talk about you. Have you ever felt that way? Have you ever gotten so discouraged that you just said to yourself, I'm out of here. I just want away from this. This is so discouraging. And the thing of it is, folks, we're going to be here to be encouraged this morning because this is not a time when David listens to that. I'm sure he had deep experiences in his life when he was overpowered by discouragement. In fact, if you look at the Psalms, you will find times like that. That's not this time. This is where David is at his best. This is where the leader truly shines in this man. Because when people say these things to David, David responds back to them and he has something to say to them. And David says, you know, the answer to this problem is not to run from it. Do you know that's true? If you run from a problem, it doesn't go away. Did you know that? I mean, it sounds so simple that you ask yourself the question, why would we ever do that? But we do. You have problems. You've got to face problems. You can't run from problems. As bad as you feel, as low as you get, as many challenges you have, as much pain as you feel in your heart, you really can't run from it because all that happens is you change the scenery, but the problem is still there. And so here's a time when David is at his best. He rises in leadership. He says to them, when they say this to him, flee as a bird to the mountain. It's so bad, what can the righteous do? The foundations all around are crumbling. What can we really do? And David has three things, and he says, you know, the answer is not resignation. It's resolve. Just remember that. It's not resignation, it's resolve. And then he gives them three things to remember in the face of discouragement. That's going to be my message this morning. Three things to remember in the face of discouragement. This begins in the first part of verse 4. Now, I think I have everybody's attention in this auditorium this morning, at least right now. As you put up your hand, tell me you haven't been discouraged. I won't go any further because some of you might be desperately discouraged right now. And you are going to see in just a moment how I relate this to where we are with Sanctity of Human Life Sunday. But I want you to see that because it's understanding the psalm, I think, really how the psalm is meant to be understood. Here's the first one. It's in verse 4, the first part. He says this back to these people. Here's David. Here's the other voice. Here's the voice of leadership. Here's the voice of inspiration. Here's the voice that says, here's how you deal with discouragement in your life. The first thing he says is, the Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. What's that mean? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. Well, here's the first thing you got to remember. Hey, look, I'm not preaching to you. I'm preaching for the benefit of all of us. Here's the first thing all of us have to remember. God is always on his throne. God is always on his throne. Where is God? How many times have we been so discouraged? How many times have we been so sunken so low and felt like God has not kept his promises? He's abandoned his word. He's forsaken me. What is going on? Nothing in life makes sense. And one of the first things, you have to sit yourself down in a chair and have a little conversation with yourself. I don't know if you believe in that, but I do that all the time. I just sit myself down in an imaginary chair and have a little talk. And I've told you this before, but one of the things that I find myself saying to myself all the time when I sit myself down in the chair is, you know, it doesn't take any talent to be discouraged. Anybody can be discouraged. What takes the grace of God and the power of God is to rise above that. And one of the first things that you've got to remember is, listen, God hasn't gone anywhere. God is always on his throne. Now, how does that relate to us where we are? I think it relates to us where we are in America today. And maybe, of course, this is reaching out to you on a personal level with where you are right now. And it's something that I don't have any knowledge of. That's okay. Because that's what you came here for. Not to tell all your secrets, but to be ministered to. But I look at America today, and boy, I tell you what, I think this psalm is exactly the right message for us. At least this is what God directed in for today. I mean, it would be so easy just to, I mean, if you look around, you get discouraged, right? I mean, let's think for a moment about abortion. Here we have something in America which is masquerading as women's rights. And instead promotes the murder of innocents. Wow. You know, folks, we've just come through the Christmas season. And if you tell that story of Herod, and most Bibles that will divide, you know, like into paragraphs or something like that, will get to that story about Herod and the children at Bethlehem, and it will call it the slaughter of the innocents. Have you ever noticed that? So often that's what a Bible will call that, the slaughter of the innocents. If I came in here, or frankly, really, anywhere in America today, I think this would still be true. And we had a situation where someone went into a town and picked all the children under 2 years old and slaughtered them. There would be moral outrage. Even in America today, there would be moral outrage. Here's a question. Where's the moral outrage when the abortionist intrudes into a place that God designed for protection and for the development and sanctity of human life and rips that life out of there? Where's the outrage? How in the world can the United States of America, a country in which our founding document, right in the Declaration of Independence, talks about certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and you take away the life and deprive any possibility of the pursuit of liberty or happiness. But it's okay. There's no moral outrage. That's discouraging. Or, here's another example. We have gay rights. Don't you? Isn't it interesting how it's always rights? Someone's rights? We have gay rights. And now, what do we have, 16 or 17 states that have legalized gay marriage? So now you have something that pawns itself off as equality and acceptance, but is destroying the traditional definition of marriage, which has existed for centuries. In fact, has existed since the Garden of Eden. Pretty easy to see why people would say to David, if the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? What can we do? Did you ever feel powerless? Did you ever feel that way? I mean, did you ever feel like you're a member of Calvary Independent Baptist Church, or you attend here on a regular basis, or you come once in a while and you hear something like this and you say, well, isn't there, what can I do? Well, what am I supposed to do? I mean, the preacher gets up there and talks about it, but frankly, what am I supposed to do? They got those 9 fuzzy-headed liberals or whatever on the Supreme Court. Well, I guess they're not all liberals and not all fuzzy-headed, but what am I supposed to do? You know, it's just, and then it just, you pick up the news. Did you ever notice the news is discouraging? Good night. I mean, Illinois legalizes gay marriage. Hawaii legalizes gay marriage. I mean, you pick up the paper every other day, it's something else, someone else. You think to yourself, wow, it just one by one, like dominoes, they keep crumbling. And if the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? And it's just a little discouraging, I think. And I think, though, of what David was saying back to these people when he was saying, the Lord is in his holy temple, the Lord is on his throne in heaven. You know, the king, with a capital K, the king, with a capital K, he's in residence, brother, he's not in flight. And David says, the first thing, you've got to sit yourself down in the chair and have this little conversation with yourself. When you get discouraged about these things, you think, well, what can I do? I just throw the towel in. There's nothing I can really do. And you become discouraged with all these things. And David says, have this little conversation and be reminded, you know, your ultimate security was never in the mountain anyway. That's what it says here, right? They say to David, or he questions back what they've said, how say ye to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? Now that's really interesting, isn't it? Because it doesn't say flee as a bird to the mountain. It says flee as a bird to your mountain. Now think about David, because certainly David, especially prior to the time that he ascended the throne, he was on the run, right, from King Saul. And he certainly had many places that he hid. He had his little hideouts in the wilderness. And so it's interesting that it's personalized. How say ye to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? That makes it personal to us this morning, because where do you go when you get like that? Listen, I'm not here to make you feel worse. Some of you already feel bad. I'm not here to make you feel worse. But where do you go? Where do you go when you get this way? Well, God has put some things around us that can help. But you know, ultimately, the true source of security was never the mountain. Remember in Psalm 121, that's one of the Psalms of Ascent. In other words, it's one of the Psalms that the pilgrims, when they were going to Jerusalem for the feast, they were to do this three times a year. And that Psalm is one of those Psalms. And it says, I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills. Now, we have to get this punctuated properly, because what happens next is it really comes a question. From whence cometh my help? My help cometh from the Lord, which made heaven and earth. I mean, the mountain, or whatever place you go, or whatever person you go to, not saying some of that isn't helpful and used by God, but I'm just telling you that the ultimate security was never those things anyway. It was always God. It was always God. I was interested, and I wanted to read this to you. This is actually a brief quotation from a book that was written back in the quotation was 3 months before Pearl Harbor, so I assume this was published or came out roughly at about this time. But the title of the book is At Dawn We Slept. Here's what the writer says. Now just listen. 3 months before Pearl Harbor, this was September 6, 1941. 3 months before Pearl Harbor. Here's what he says. A Japanese attack on Hawaii is regarded as the most unlikely thing in the world, with one chance in a million of being successful, besides sharing more powerful defenses than any other post under the American flag. It is protected by distance. Well, Yamamoto and a few of the others had different ideas, didn't they? What were people trusting in then? Defenses and distance, defenses and distance, defenses and distance. Like a guy walking along and trying to support himself with a rotten cane. You put your security, put your trust in something that's going to fail you sooner or later. You know, I don't know why I think about this, but at least it'll communicate to a lot of people. But a number of years ago, it may have been when I went to Colorado for the first time, Jack. I bought one of those Primos shooting sticks. A lot of you know what that is. Now, they're available in different iterations, but this particular one is just, it's what you'd call a monopod, because it's only one thing. And the way this works is, you know, you get a little place at the top where you can rest your rifle, and then it has a place in the middle where you can adjust it, so you turn it to do that. And when you turn it, then it telescopes in and out, so depending on what height you need to be at with this thing. But you don't have a tripod, you don't have a bipod, you just have the one thing. Well, if you're going along with this thing, and then at the top, if you want to adjust the top half some more, then it's got like a trigger. You grasp that thing. When you grasp that thing, it moves for you. Well, you get this thing, and it gives you this dire warning. Do not, under any circumstances, not any day of the week, not any moment of the year, do not use this as a walking stick. It's not quite so dire, but it does, no skull and crossbones, but it definitely tells you, don't use this thing as a walking stick. Have I ever used it as a walking stick? Lots of times. Lots of times. For the simple reason that when you got a pack on your back and you got all this equipment, you got a rifle over here, and you're toting this thing along, that's Southern for carrying. You're toting this thing along, and especially if the ground is uneven, boy, you would be surprised how beneficial a walking stick is. And you don't have to be 90 years old. A walking stick is a big help. But boy, I'll tell you one thing, you better be mighty careful. You've got that thing tight in the middle, and you better be double mighty careful. You don't reach up there by mistake and hit that trigger. Because if you do that, you know what's going to happen? Whoop! It's going down, and probably you are too if you put your weight on it. And folks, that's the reason that we get discouraged. We get our eyes off the fact that our ultimate security is in God. It always has been. God hasn't gone anywhere. The king is in residence. That's what David is trying to say to them. You're telling me to flee from Jerusalem, but God hasn't gone anywhere. The answer to this problem is not resignation. It's not resignation. Because God hasn't gone anywhere. He's still on the throne. So when I look out in America, or I turn on the news and say, you know, this is discouraging. Another state legalized gay marriage. Or, you know, we lost a deal here on trying to do something with abortion. And I don't know. It's discouraging. But you know, I don't know what God is doing in our country. Well, I do know some things. He's judging it, for one thing. But I don't really know the grander scheme. God didn't see fit to give me that telegram. I didn't get that email. But I trust him. I trust him. He's all-powerful. He doesn't make any mistakes. He hasn't gone anywhere. All right, now that leads us to the next thing. And we see this in the second part of verse 4. And the first part of verse 5, where it says this, his eyes behold, his eyelids try the children of men. The Lord trieth the righteous. So I'm going to ask myself the question, well, if God is in heaven, and I'm supposed to first of all remember that God is always on his throne, what's the second thing I got to remember? The second thing I got to remember is God sometimes tests. God sometimes tests the righteous. So let me try to put this out here for you. If God is on the throne, but the foundations around us are crumbling, what's God doing and what is God doing? See, you and I are so much like the disciples, and this is one of the reasons, I guess, my favorite place in the Bible is the Gospels, because I love to read those stories. And I think about these fishermen. Guys that were seasoned fishermen. And they're out there in that boat. And Jesus, the Bible tells us when you read this story in Mark chapter 4, Jesus is in the stern, the King James Version says the hinder part of the boat. Jesus in the stern, he's asleep with his head on a pillow. Don't you love that? The Lord of heaven and earth is never worried about anything. Man, I wish I could do that. I wish I could do that. I feel so ashamed that I don't have greater victory in that area. And these guys are out there, and all of a sudden, one of those sudden storms that the Sea of Galilee is so prone to, that defile in the north, that geographical lay of the land, the Araba, as it's called, where that north, that wind from the north, suddenly just come barreling and be tunneled tightly down upon that frying pan lake is what it is. Some 800 feet below sea level already, it is. Did you know that? Sea of Galilee is some 700 to 800 feet below sea level. And that wind come barreling down and subject to those sudden storms, and all of a sudden those waves begin to rise and the wind begins to blow, and it's not fun when they start breaking into the boat, the water. You start taking on water. And they go back there and they wake him up and they say, Master, carest thou not that we perish? What's the problem? See, we're all the time mistaking the fact that when God seems to be still, that he's either unaware or not doing anything. When in reality, don't ever mistake God's stillness for God's inaction. What is he doing? Well, I can't give you the whole answer to that, but I can tell you one thing. One of the things that he's often doing is he's often testing his people. Why does he test his people? Because he wants to grow us. He wants to grow us. He wants us to be stronger Christians. How are we going to become stronger Christians if he doesn't test us? It just doesn't work any other way. You know, if those guys in that boat always had balmy breezes, never had any storms, if you never had any storms, if I never had any storms, we would just tell everybody, you know, that you should become a Christian. It's a cakewalk. This is great. Well, it is great, but I mean, how would you grow? How would you prove God's faithfulness? How would you know that his grace is sufficient? How would you magnify and glorify God because he's bigger than your problems if you don't have any problems? Somehow, beloved, I and you, we need to change our mental outlook. This is what the devil does. He obscures these truths from us so that we're overwhelmed by all of these problems, and we need to sit ourselves down in the little chair and have the conversation with ourselves. And the first thing you're going to say is, you know, I need to remember when people are telling me, just toss in the towel. I need to remember God hasn't gone anywhere. He's always on his throne. He's still in control of this show. God's still in control of Washington, D.C., I mean, it looks out of control to me, but God is still in control. I'm glad I believe that. Second thing, I got to sit myself down in a little chair and say, you know, I've got to remember that just because he seems like he's asleep, because it seems like he's not doing anything, doesn't mean he's not doing anything. In fact, I know he's active. I know he's busy. I know he's working in hearts. He's working in my life. And then I can't help but think of the three Hebrew children, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You know, those guys knew that. They knew exactly what I'm trying to tell you this morning. Because, I mean, you get to the end of Daniel chapter 2, and finally after Nebuchadnezzar hears that dream and Daniel interprets the dream for him, and he makes this confession, you think, now we're on the right road. Now we're getting somewhere. Because he says, truly your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings. It just wish that would have taken. But somehow you get to the next chapter, and it didn't quite stay with him. And this thing went to his head about the fact that he was the head of gold. Right? Remember that? The image, and he's the head of gold, and it goes to his head. And so he erects this big thing, and he says, everybody's going to bow down to this. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego come along, and you know, they don't make a big row and say this, that, or that, but they just say, can't do it. Can't do it. That's something I can't compromise. You have anything in your life you can't compromise? That's just something I can't do. It's against my moral principles. I won't do that. And they get reported. Somebody rats them out. King says, is this true? They said, it's true, okay. Well, I'm heating the furnace 7 times hotter. Throw you in there too. Then who's God? Huh? He says that. Then who's God's going to deliver you out of my hand? I love the way they respond to him. Not a bunch of rednecks. Not a bunch of jerks. They just say, King, we're not careful. We're not worried to answer you concerning this matter. And they let the king know. You can heat your furnace and do all that, but just know this. We're not bowing down to your golden image. Oh, he's in a rage. You talk about being out of control. He's in a rage. He throws them in there. You know the rest of the story. Somehow, do you get the idea that these guys sat themselves down in the little chair and had the conversation with themselves and said, you know, God isn't asleep. He's still on his throne and he's doing something. We don't know what he's doing. In fact, we don't even know if we're walking out of this thing. But we know he's able for us to walk out of here if that's what he so chooses. They knew that. I like the story of the minister who was on the train, and he was riding across the country, and he happened to be in a particular little compartment where only he and another fellow were in the compartment. And this other fellow was a young man, and he was a Christian, and he was reading a newspaper. And so it wasn't long before they struck up a bit of conversation, and the minister soon learned that the young man was just, he was really discouraged, just desperately discouraged. In fact, with the temptations and all the different things that he was, problems he was experiencing in his life, he told the minister, he said, I just don't know that I can go another week. And the minister had a Bible, he got the Bible out, and then he went in his pocket and got a penknife out. He said, I want to show you something. He said, I want to show you how I can make this penknife stand on this Bible. You know, think about this for a minute. You know, you have a train. I don't know if you have one of these little pull-down trays or what, but he sets the Bible, train's doing this number. And he says, yeah, I'm going to show you how I can make this penknife stand up on this Bible. So he gets the penknife, he puts it there, and he holds it up. And the guy says, hey, he said, that thing's not standing up on there on its own. He said, you're holding it up there. The minister said, just so. It's impossible for it to do that on its own. Did you know the same thing's true for you and me? It's impossible to do this on our own. Underneath are the everlasting arms. Underneath are the everlasting arms. That's what we have to remember. Sometimes God's testing us. Sometimes he's teaching us, you have to lean on me. You have to realize you're not going to go through this experience. It will overwhelm you. You are going to be defeated by this thing if you don't realize penknives don't stand up on Bibles on their own when they're rocking back and forth, only if something supports them. And the last thing that we have to remember is, in the psalm at least, comes to us at the end of verse number 5 and into the last of the psalm where it says, but, I'm in verse 5 with the word but the wicked and him that loveth violence his soul hateth. Upon the wicked he shall rain snares, fire and brimstone, and in horrible tempest. This shall be the portion of their cup, for the righteous Lord loveth righteousness. His countenance doth behold the upright. What's the last thing we're going to remember? Last thing, got to sit ourselves down in a little chair and have this conversation and say, God, here's something else you have to remember. You have to remember that God ultimately judges the wicked. Do you notice that the psalmist has a way of using polar opposites here? I think it's designed to get our attention. Because when someone speaks in, well, what he says is true, so I won't say it's hyperbole here, but when someone speaks in what appears to be more extreme language, we listen to it for a moment. And why that's true here is, look at the terms he uses, talking about polar opposites. In verse 5, he says, for the Lord trieth the righteous, but the wicked. So, polar opposites. You have the righteous and you have the wicked. And as the thing progresses, he does this again. Verse 6, upon the wicked. But in verse number 7, for the righteous Lord loveth righteousness, his countenance doth behold the upright, the righteous. Polar opposites. What is the response? What is the difference between God, how God handles the wicked and the righteous? Well, it says in verse 4, he's going to rain snares, fire, and brimstone, and in horrible tempest. That's the portion of their cup. But as far as the righteous is concerned, the Lord loves the righteous. And in fact, it says at the end of the verse, his countenance doth behold the upright. You know, ultimately what that means is that ultimately the righteous are in God's presence. His countenance is his face. Ultimately the righteous are in God's presence. Now, you know, you and I here this morning are in God's presence now, but think about it in the ultimate sense. Think about it when it's all over. Think about it when all the trials of earth and all the temptations to discouragement and all the seeming onslaught of victories of evil. Think about when all those are over, where's it going to end? Where is it going to end? Well, if you're here today and you know Jesus Christ as personal Savior, I'll tell you where it's going to end. You're going to be in his presence. It's not true for the wicked. God is going to rain snares and brimstone and judgment. I'm not saying here this morning that there's not a whole lot of stuff that goes on in between. Because that's what's going on now. You know, we're living, some Bible students like to call where we are now the age of grace. I'm not much on that terminology because God never operates any other way but grace. But you know what I'm trying to say. I mean, the gospel is being disseminated to the ends of the earth. God is tolerating the wicked right now. While he's tolerating the wicked, he also reaches out to them. You and I should do that too. Hard sometimes, isn't it? Really hard to do that sometimes, but that's exactly what we're put here for. Who knows when God is going to touch someone's heart? You know, I keep thinking about Nebuchadnezzar. And I keep thinking about the difference between him and Pharaoh. And God raised this man up, this Pharaoh. God raised him up to demonstrate his power. And when the whole thing was over with, this man in his hardened condition who would not turn to God and who in response to all of his response was hardened by God, finds himself cast in defeat and death on the shores of the Red Sea for everyone to see. And I think about this man Nebuchadnezzar. He had some pride too. But God working in his heart, God working in his life, humbling him. They cast him out 7 years. And at the end, finally, I think it makes its way from here that God is the King of Kings and the Lord of Kings and the God of Gods. Finally, I think it makes its way here. And it's not. I'm not saying to you here this morning, beloved, I'm not saying that we're cheering on this judgment. I'm not saying that we should pray in precatory prayers. There might be a time for that, but that's not what I'm talking about this morning. I'm saying there is a certain comfort in understanding where this thing is going to end because it is not going to end with these people having the upper hand. It is going to end in victory for those who know and love God. Somehow I just have to keep remembering that when they keep legalizing in another state. When I get to another year and have to preach another sermon on the sanctity of human life Sunday, and I have to tell you three more million babies have been aborted. And we're up to nearly 60 million. I don't know, there is maybe some hope. It's kind of interesting. Rand Paul has a bill that he's promoting. I can't take time to tell you about it now, but if successful, would basically totally eliminate the legal underpinnings of Roe versus Wade. It's really interesting to read this. I don't know if that can go anywhere. But even the justices who wrote the decision in 1973 admitted that if what we're dealing here with is not a fetus, but is in fact a life, you have no leg to stand on. Because then you have constitutional protection if you admit that you have a life. And in other words, Rand Paul's logic is you use the Constitution against them. And it's a really interesting read. Maybe you should look at it sometime and see what you think, and maybe you send a contribution to the, not to him personally for his campaign if you don't like him, but for the organization and that's supporting this. Think I will. Where's the moral outrage? Where are the people of Calvary Independent Baptist Church? You can't necessarily take the right to life bus to Washington. Some people might be able to. What are you going to do? Go around there, parade in front of the Supreme Court? Well, you could. I mean, you know, at least you get a few cameras, take your picture. But you can pray and you can work and you cannot give up. Because at the end of the day, that isn't God's plan. God's plan is never resignation. Not in that sense. We don't resign from the Lord's army. We keep fighting. We keep going. So I ask you this because I have to close the message. I'm out of time. What's it going to be for Calvary Independent Baptist Church? What's God called us to do? Well, what's God called the church to do? We should read it in 1 Timothy 3:15. I didn't invent this. He says he's called us to be the pillar and the ground of the truth. The pillar and the ground of the truth. In other words, he raises up churches like this one. We aren't the only ones. Raises up churches like this one and puts them there in society so that God has people who are defending the truth. who are speaking for the truth, who won't give up on the truth, who will keep proclaiming the truth. Think of it like a bulwark. When all of those waves come lashing in, and it seems to be so overwhelming, the power of those waves, the height of those waves, it seems to be so powerful and so overwhelming, but there's a bulwark there. And those waves break against that bulwark, and that's what the church is designed to be, the bulwark for the truth, a pillar and ground. Pillars support things, and bulwark defend against things. And I ask you, on this Sanctity of Human Life Sunday, as someone who attends this church, or you attended today, you're a Christian, don't resign. Don't resign in the moral battle that's going on in America today. Don't resign in your personal life. Anybody can be discouraged. Probably a lot of us are. Doesn't take any talent. What takes the real grace of God, what takes the real power of God is to sit yourself down in that chair and say, I'm not going there. I refuse by God's grace to be overwhelmed by these things, because there are at least three things that I can remember. And remember, God is always on the throne. He's always on the throne. And that's not just for Washington. That's for me, like here in Huntington up there at 331 Simpson Street. He's always on the throne. Where is he? What's he doing when I can't find him? Well, he's probably growing me. That's what he's doing, among other things. I don't know all what else he's doing, among other things. And am I really worried about where it's going to end? No, I'm not. Because what God says is this: those who set themselves and will not turn aside, those who set themselves to destroy the very foundations that God himself has laid, the very moral underpinnings of society. I'm talking to Barack Obama. Why single him out? He's the leader of our country. He's the person promoting all this stuff. It's like the preacher of your church. If he runs around sleeping with women all the time, what message does that send? How does that... I'm not saying he's doing that. I'm making a point. I'm saying, how does that lead people in the way of righteousness? I have a responsibility to lead by example and by precept. So I don't have a problem. I'm not doing this in unkindness, but I don't have a problem with calling him out. You need to understand something, Mr. President, that those who set themselves to dig up and destroy the foundations of society, God is going to destroy the wicked. And God is going to deliver the righteous. Amen. They can throw us in. They may do it too. I'm not standing in line. It's hot in there. They may throw us in the fiery furnace. Before this thing's over with, didn't you remember what Jesus said? The people kill you, they'll think they're doing God a favor. Remember that? So maybe this afternoon, just get a quiet place if you need it. Sit down and have that little conversation with yourself. Whatever it is you're going through right now. Hard, isn't it? Really hard. Hard not to be overwhelmed. Hard not to cry. Hard not to hurt in here with some of the things that God lets us go through in our lives. Why? Where are you, God? Don't you know how bad it hurts? Well, son, I'm just taking a little time to grow you. I'm taking a little time to make you more like my son. And don't give up, because I put you there for people to see Jesus in you. I put you there to be a pillar and ground of the truth. I put you there so that there's somebody in society that people can look to and say, you know, this is what God says. I don't care what they all say. This is what God says. Father, come to our aid. Please come to our aid. Because we need you when we see the foundations being destroyed. Not to give up. Not to grow weary in well-doing. And if it's not looking around at what's going on in America or the world, we need you for what seems to be going on sometimes in our own lives. Help us. Deliver us from our own weakness. Look down this morning and remind both yourself and us that our frames are dust. Have pity and mercy on us and give us your strength. And help us to remember, it's not resignation, it's resolve. I pray these things in Jesus' wonderful name. Amen.